plug it in later.
Okay.
Yeah, just to, let's see if I can just get it. Okay.
Just wait till you see the song and dance portion of this. It's amazing.
As you can see, we've got media. And then the main thing, this is the studio, because it'll be on radio and it will be downloaded. So just so I'm clear that it is all
right
out
go
there.
Go. So watch my opinions.
All right, good morning and welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Preston Connor. I'll be your host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute of Politics was established in 1965 through a generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching student respect for practical politics and principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 55 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website at www.hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The Hinckley Institute of Politics proudly presents the 17th annual Rocco C. and Marion S. Siciliano Forum. This year's theme is the future of U.S.-Latin American relations. This is one of 21 events that will extend through next Monday. For a listing of all the events, we encourage you to pick up a brochure in the back of the room. The title of today's forum is Hispanic Business, What the Fastest Growing Segment of American Enterprise Means for the U.S. Today's guest is Javier Palomares. He's the president and CEO of the United States Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. It's America's largest Hispanic business association. The USHCC actively promotes the economic growth, development, and interest of more than 300 million Hispanic-owned businesses that combined contribute over $486 billion to the American economy every year. It also advocates on behalf of 240 major American corporations and serves as the umbrella organization for more than 200 local chambers and business associations nationwide. Mr. Palomares has been appointed to the National Advisory Council on Minority Business at the Department of Commerce. He also serves on the FCC Federal Advisory Committee on Diversity, Comcast NBC Universal Diversity Advisory Council, and the Goldman Sachs 10,000 Small Business Advisory Board. Javier also serves on the Senate Task Force on Corporate Diversity and Inclusion and is the director of the Hispanic Association on Corporate Responsibility. He has consistently appeared on Latino Leaders Magazine 100 Most Influential list and was named one of the 75 most influential Hispanics and top 100 green CEOs by Poder Magazine. Palomares was also profiled by El País, Spain's leading daily news outlet, and was featured in British Broadcasting Corporation's 10 Latinos Who Made History in 2012. Please join me in welcoming our guest today.
Thank you, Preston. You read that just the way I wrote it, so I really appreciate that very much. It's a real pleasure to be back in Utah, if only just for a very short while. Embajador, welcome, sir. I hope I don't screw this up in your presence. Kirk, thank you for having me. It's always great to collaborate with you and Hinckley. And so faculty, ladies and gentlemen, esteemed guests, and especially students. Again, my name is Javier Palomares, and I am the president and CEO of the United States Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. And I have the honor, as Preston said, of representing the interests of 3.2 million Hispanic-owned businesses in this country. That, as he said, contributes over $486 billion to the American economy every year. We also advocate on behalf of 245 major American corporations, and we do this through our network of 200 local chambers throughout the United States, proudly one right here in the state of Utah. And while the USHCC represents the interests of businessmen and women who happen to be of Hispanic descent, we never forget that we are first and foremost American businesses. So every tax bill we pay, every job we create, every product we manufacture, and every service we provide goes to benefit the American economy. And whether it's in the halls of Congress, the White House, state capitals, or corporate headquarters all over this country, our organization strives to place America's small business community, the very engine of job creation in this country, at the forefront of the nation's economic agenda. Our objective is to broaden opportunities for emerging leaders and all of you, especially the young people in this room, the next generation of successful professionals. But in today's increasingly competitive world, organizations like ours cannot open doors of opportunity for your generation unless our academic institutions offer a world-class education and they make it within reach. And by all measure, the Hinckley Institute has faithfully delivered on that commitment. The education that you receive here is preparing you for the adventures and, frankly, the adversities that exist beyond these halls. Your professors are doing more, I think, than teaching a curriculum. In my mind, they are empowering you to defy expectations and to prove that today's millennials are tomorrow's hope and America's greatest generation. For over 50 years, this institution has stood the test of time. Hinckley is one of the first of its kind in this nation, and it was founded with the mission of engaging students in the political process. And perhaps that's more important than ever. Through the Siciliano series, you're all gaining a wealth of knowledge and a true understanding of the interplay between the private and public sectors and how unfolding national and international events, frankly, impact us all. So in keeping with this tradition, today's lecture, and I'm using the term very loosely here, today's lecture will be future-focused. Today, we'll take a look at America's Hispanic community, its positive impact, and the contributions to our nation's economy, our way of life, and how it can serve as a contribution to a shared American future. So let's get started. And I'm going to apologize in advance. I'm no professor, so I'll do the best I can in terms of lecturing here. I think that what we'll do is we'll take a look at a number of things here. I'll begin kind of generally with some demographics, talk about Hispanics and education in this country, the Hispanic electorate, which I think is something that's quite interesting, at least as far as I'm concerned. Can you still hear me with this? I think the implications of a Hispanic electorate, even as a business person, I think are very dynamic and very interesting as we move forward as a nation. The role that Hispanics are actually playing in politics and the challenges that lie ahead for this community. I'll look at the consumers in this segment, our economy, and within the economy, because we don't have enough time, I'll look at two opposite ends of the spectrum, Hispanics in agriculture and Hispanics in technology. And then I think a peek at the future, and I think in keeping with the guests that we have here and kind of the work that's happening in the state of Utah, we'll take a very, very small look at international trade and the potential that Hispanics have to influence and work even in that environment. I think that the important thing here, first of all, is, in my opinion, the real question as it relates to America's Hispanic community is, as a race, as a community that's growing dynamically within the boundaries of the United States, the real question in my mind is this community evolving? Is it integrating? Is it growing in a fashion that's a benefit to the American economy and the American way of life? And I think there are metrics that one could look at. Is the Hispanic community acculturating? Is it engaged in terms of education? Is educational attainment something that's important? And can we prove that, in fact, Hispanics are attaining education at a level that's commensurate with the growth? Creation of wealth within that community. The economic impact. Is it a positive impact? Net-net, is it a positive impact? And then finally, at least as it relates to jobs, one segment of the economy, Are Hispanics filling the jobs of the future? Or even better yet, are they creating the jobs of the future? And I'll try to give us a small peek at all of these dynamics in the following presentation. First, let's begin with demographics. So the Hispanic community, between the years 2000 and 2010, the last time it was studied, Hispanics contributed over 51% of the total population growth of the United States. Think about that. One community, frankly, created most of the positive growth in the population of the U.S. And in certain metropolitan areas, like Chicago, Rahm Emanuel's a friend of mine, so I like to pick on him. The Chicagoland kind of metropolitan area, if you were to remove the Hispanic population growth of that segment of the country, there would have been negative growth. Said another way, there were more people leaving the Chicago metropolitan area than there were people coming in. Were it not for the growth of the Hispanic community, that particular part of the world would have experienced negative growth. So you see the impact, certainly in major metropolitan areas like New York, Chicago, Houston, Dallas, Austin, and Los Angeles and Miami, where the Hispanic community, frankly, is over-indexing in terms of the contribution that they make to the economy of those very strong local economies. Today, there are 52 million Hispanics in the U.S. And on a going-forward basis, Hispanics will comprise a little upwards of 53% of the total growth of the American population over the next 5 years. Think about that. One community continues to create more than half of the growth of this entire nation, which will put them at about 66 million Hispanics in the U.S. in just 5 years. As we stand right now, one in six people breathing in the United States is of Hispanic descent. So as I like to say only half jokingly, if you're not related to a Latino, like right now, give us about 15 minutes and we'll get around to you as well. Only half jokingly. If you look at Hispanics in education, because certainly this is both an opportunity area for the Hispanic community, but it continues to be a challenge for the Hispanic community. But there are some wonderful bright spots here. First, taking a look at the median age of the Hispanic community in the U.S. The median age of a Latino in the U.S. is 27 years, while the median age of their Caucasian counterparts is 42 years. There's a 15-year spread. That 15 years is incredibly important in terms of building employment, jobs, and an economy on a going-forward basis. Right now, a quarter of all kids under the age of 5 in the U.S. is Hispanic. And right now, one-fourth of all children in public school from kindergarten to 12th grade is of Hispanic descent, a brand new demographic milestone for this community. And interestingly, 2 years ago, I believe, we looked at the number of Hispanics who made it to the 12th grade and then the enrollment rates into college between the Hispanic community, the Caucasian community, and the African American community. The good news, Hispanics had a 33% increase in the enrollment in STEM-related programs, science, technology, engineering, and math, compared to a 21% increase on a national basis. So the fact is that Hispanics, when they get to the 12th grade, are very interested in things like engineering, mathematics, and technology. I think critically important for a nation that continues to build, from a technology standpoint, our future, and is the world-class leader, frankly, on all things having to do with technology. The question is, where are the future engineers coming from? And I'm happy to say that disproportionately, they're coming from the Hispanic community. In 2013, almost 70% of Hispanics who made it through high school enrolled in college. Now think about that. Almost 70% compared to 67% of their Caucasian white counterparts and only 58% of their African-American counterparts. So if they make it to 12th grade, they disproportionately enroll into college. The challenge we have, and the cautionary note here, is that not enough Latinos are making it to the 12th grade. But at least one of the questions has been removed. So there was always two questions. Can you get them through high school? And when you get them through high school, will they go to college? Well, we've answered one of the questions. Disproportionately, they're enrolling to go to college, which is a good thing economically for this nation. The real challenge for us as a community, as a country, is do we continue to invest in these Hispanic young people and getting them through the 12th grade? Because obviously, they're taking advantage and moving on into college. Now, the Hispanic electorate, this is a really fun part for me. Not that I'm in politics, but I like to watch politics. I'm very intrigued by it, especially in today's environment. The Hispanic electorate, I think, is going to be critically important as we move forward as a country. If you look at recently, I think, closely watched elections, and you begin on one side of the country with arguably the number one local economy in this country, that being New York. That's debatable, but New York would tell you they're the number one economy in this country. Mayor Bill de Blasio won the mayoral race, and I believe that part of the reason he won was because he had almost 90% of the Hispanic vote in that city. On the other end of the spectrum, on the other side of the country, the number two local economy would be Los Angeles, and Eric Garcetti won the Los Angeles mayoral race, and he had 60% of the Hispanic vote. In both cases, they will both tell you that the Hispanic vote was critically important to them attaining that office. If you look at Governor Chris Christie, 51% of the Hispanic vote, and he took the gubernatorial race in the state of New Jersey. And I think the big one for me was President Barack Obama. His first time around, I think 2008, he had 70% of the Hispanic vote. It's very rare that you see that kind of a voting bloc so unanimously in favor of one candidate. And then in 2012, 71% of the Hispanic vote. And I had an opportunity right after the vote or the election in 2012 to speak to the president about a couple of things. And one of them was the electorate and the impact. And I shared with the president that in my view, never before has the Hispanic vote played such a critical role in electing an American president. But what I think is even more interesting, at least to me, is that never again in my lifetime, never again will there be an American president elected without openly courting America's Hispanic vote. Think about the implications that exist just in that statement and what it means for anybody wanting to gain the office of President of the United States. The real question and the takeaway for me is whether the Hispanic community can be coaxed and can be convinced that the vote is so critically important. Because clearly, the Hispanic vote can make a difference, but we again disproportionately under-index in terms of involvement in voting. So the real trick is not only in winning the Hispanic vote, but in consistently, I think, messaging to the Hispanic community that their vote is in fact important. And one of the kind of interesting factoids is that every 30 seconds, a Latino turns 18 in this country and becomes eligible to vote. Said another way, 50,000 Hispanics will turn 18 every single month for the next 21 years in the United States of America. Think about what that means for elections on a going forward basis. Coincidentally, during the same 30 seconds that a Hispanic turns 18 and becomes eligible to vote and to work, in the same 30 seconds, a non-Hispanic white becomes of retirement age. So think about the implications 10, 15 years from now in terms of who's retiring and who's filling the jobs of the future and frankly keeping this huge boat called America afloat. In my mind, what it says is that we have a vested interest in ensuring that America's Hispanic community continues to get educated so that they can become the workers of the future. I think I'm safe in saying that predominantly And historically, the Hispanic vote in America has leaned to the left a bit. It's been Democrat. But even within that, there's change coming. And I'd like to play a little video here that kind of speaks to this phenomenon.
Being American involves celebrating my dad as a veteran, celebrating my mom as a retired school teacher, and being a business owner in Texas. My politics are conservative, less government, less red tape. I'm an ordinary American that prioritizes faith and family.
I think it's kind of shortened to the point, but it's very telling. By the way, that's Mark Rodriguez, former chairman of the board of the United States Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. I think it's very telling that even as we stand, that we're seeing the lines graying, that we're seeing a community evolving, growing, and coming into its own, finding its own voice in the national narrative. And oftentimes you'll see, I think, on a going forward basis, growth in the Republican Party. And I think a leaning a little bit more toward the center or the right. The reality of it is, if you look at, in my opinion, kind of the key characteristics that are espoused by the Republican Party, the ethos of the Republican Party, things that are centered around loyalty and country and discipline and hard work and family and faith, and you were to look at the perfect candidate, the perfect voter for those exact same characteristics, the Hispanic American family and voter is almost perfectly aligned with that same ethos. This notion of hard work, family first, faith, loyalty to this country, I mean, the matchup could not be better. So on a going forward basis, it'll be very interesting to see how these large blocks, predominantly Democrat and Republican, of course, there's other players, will play to that ethos and that philosophy that exists in the Hispanic community. And I think it's going to get very interesting as we move forward here. Now, how are Hispanics faring within the political environment? Well, the 114th Congress, our current Congress, is the most Hispanic Congress ever, with 29 members in the House and 3 in the Senate. The breakdown still is predominantly Democrat, but growing in the Republican Party. And as we stand, there are 12 Hispanics that currently hold a statewide office in California, Colorado, Florida, Illinois, New Mexico, Texas, but God help us, in the state of Utah as well. Who'd have thunk it? In the state of Utah, you'd see a Hispanic Republican holding statewide office, and that individual is Attorney General Sean Ray, is a friend and somebody that we're very happy to see has ascended to that role. An historic, I think, first step for the Hispanic community in the state. I think it's illustrative of a state that puts policy before politics, that puts people before politics, and elected what they believed was the best candidate. So happens to be a Hispanic. This is kind of a quick snapshot of some of the people that are filling office today. Administrator Contreras Sweet, a former member of the United States Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, a business owner herself. She started a small bank in California. She's an immigrant from Mexico. Started a company called Inter-American Bank. Madre mía, I forget her name. I forget the name of the bank that, of all things, specialized in small loans to small businesses all over California. I think the perfect candidate to lead the Small Business Administration. Tom Perez, Secretary of Labor, Julian Castro, a great friend of our association, spoke here last year at our national convention here in Salt Lake City. It was his first large public address, and he chose to come here to Salt Lake City to address our crowd. And you see all the other players here. With all of that said, again, a cautionary note. Despite, I think, steady progress, all of the members in the Congress represent only 6% of the population of the Congress, while Hispanics in general represent almost 17% of the overall population of the country. So I'm hopeful that as we move forward, there'll be a better representation, a stronger representation in the halls and walls of Congress. The area that I think we as an association watch most closely is the Hispanic as a consumer. A dynamic story here. An interesting aspect of the Hispanic segment is the potential for the Hispanic consumer to be an incredibly loyal consumer. The annual purchasing power of the Latino community today is $1.5 trillion. That number has surpassed projections for the last 14 years in a row. Every single year, people have tried to peg the growth of the Hispanic purchasing power, and every year it has beaten the projections. The buying power of the Hispanic community has increased 155% compared to 71% since 2000 in terms of the comparison between Hispanics and non-Hispanics. 50% of the Hispanic population, if you're a marketing or sales organization, is concentrated, 50% is concentrated in the states of Texas and California. If you're selling anything and you are trying to target the consumer of the future, wouldn't it make a lot of sense to be able to really focus your effort, your investment, your advertising, marketing, and promotions to two states as opposed to 50? And that's why the Hispanic consumer is increasingly important to practically every major American corporation. And if you were to look at the concentration of Hispanic purchasing power, you can reach it all in 10 states. Again, makes it very interesting whether you're selling Pampers to pickups, this consumer, this Hispanic family is incredibly important and I think a key to the future for many of our brands. The takeaway for me here is if you study between the years 2010 and 2015, in that mere five-year period of time, there was a 50% growth in the purchasing power of this community. There is nowhere else in America that you can see that kind of concentration and that kind of growth. If you look at it on a going forward basis, we've already determined that there'll be about 66 million Hispanics in America in about 5 years. If the same purchasing power tracks in 5 years, you're going to be looking at upwards of $2 trillion of Hispanic purchasing power. Within that community, not unlike every other community, there's the real sweet spot, the proverbial perfect consumer. And that today is referred to as upscale Hispanics. They are the most influential segment in terms of marketing and advertising since the baby boomers. It refers to about 15 million Hispanic households that have an income anywhere from $50,000 to $100,000, and again, growing disproportionately fast. Interestingly, this particular segment is not only more educated, but is bilingual. Unlike many other immigrant communities that have come to this nation, and we know of the wonderful contributions that the Italian and Polish and German communities have made and their entry into the United States and our economy, there's a difference when you study the Hispanic community today that's entering the United States or being born in the United States. By the way, another misconception that the growth of the Hispanic population is being driven by immigration. In fact, that's not true. The growth of the Hispanic population is being driven by births. And so the interesting part of what's happening with the Hispanic community today is think about it. When other nations and other countries and other peoples came to the United States, there was no way really to learn what was going on back home. So if you immigrated here from Italy in the 1910s, there was no way to kind of, there was no Italian network, there was no Facebook, there was no cellular service back and forth. You were fortunate if you could get a phone call once a year, maybe. There certainly wasn't any Italian-speaking networks that gave you the news, as it so happens that is the case today. If you look at the Hispanic immigrant of today, or even early arrival, the reality of it is Calling Mexico, calling Guatemala, calling Ecuador is incredibly easy. There are cellular networks that are absolutely available to you. There is a television network called Univision, which is actually the largest television network in the United States. It has more viewers than NBC, CBS, and ABC combined. And the number one 6 o'clock news program in the United States is in Los Angeles, but it's not NBC. It's actually Univision. If you think about the fragmentation that exists in the American and English networks, you've got MSNBC, CNBC, ABC, NBC, CBS, ESPN, and the list goes on, Fox and so forth. So it fragments that viewership. Conversely, the Hispanic viewer basically has a couple of options. One's called Telemundo, and the other one, which has about 80% of the market, is Univision. And so the reality of it is, if you're a marketer and you're trying to find the consumer of the future and you're trying to find the family that disproportionately is growing income, guess where you're going to invest? You're going to invest in Univision because that's where you're going to get your dollar's worth. And so for a business guy, and I happen to have grown up in corporate America and I was a marketing and sales guy, this dynamic was incredibly interesting to me. And the fact is, if you took the Hispanic market that exists within the United States today and you created a country in and of itself, it would have a larger economy than Mexico, a larger economy than Australia, than Saudi Arabia, or the United Arab Emirates. That's how large the Hispanic market within the United States is and growing. Hispanics in the economy. I think Hispanics and the impact to our economy are critically important. Our association looks at immigration reform as an economic imperative. It's not an issue to us. Obviously, it has to do with civil rights and individuals and families. But above and beyond that, the importance of the Hispanic community to our American economy, I think, cannot be understated and should never be forgotten. If you look at the Hispanic community in terms of creating jobs, as I mentioned earlier, Hispanic-owned businesses are incredibly rapidly growing in the U.S. They're growing at a rate of 3-1 when compared to the general market. And in fact, they doubled in size between the year 2000 and 2014. 2002, I think, and 2014. And between the years 2008 and 2014, right in the middle of an economic recession in the United States, Hispanic-owned businesses created even more companies. They created 581 new companies, not that existed, but brand new companies in that period of time, 581,000 new businesses. Had these businesses not been created, the unemployment rate in this country would have risen over 10% for the first time in over 30 years, and we would have careened much closer to a full-blown depression as opposed to the recession that we were witnessing. So in terms of creating jobs, I think the Hispanic community has done a very nice job. In terms of filling the jobs, and certainly the jobs of the future, I think it's important to remember that Hispanics will account for 40% of employment growth over the next 5 years, and up to 75% of the employment growth between the years 2020 and 2034. And so the reality of it is that once again we're faced with this stark opportunity, in my opinion, to take advantage of this growing population, to train them and frankly to put them to work. And I think that's something that the state of Utah, frankly, has done a phenomenal job at. Right now, as I mentioned earlier, there's 3.2 million Hispanic-owned businesses in this country, and they contribute in excess of $480 billion to the economy every year and growing. So I don't have time, and I don't think you can take this much longer, to cover all of the kind of the different segments of the economy. So I'll look at two. First, on one end of the economy and look at one sector, which is agriculture, and how Hispanics are faring inside that small sector or that sliver. 77% of Hispanic operators actually own the land that they are cultivating. Said another way, that equates to roughly 70,000 American farms that are owned by Hispanics. It basically makes a lot of sense. We talked about the retirement age of non-Hispanics and the growth of the Hispanic population in terms of how young they were and coming into their own. So it kind of falls kind of in keeping with that. And between the years 2007 and 2012, Hispanic farmers increased by 21%. But interestingly, there was a corresponding 4% decrease in non-Hispanic farm ownership overall. So as we see one community, one race getting out of farming, perhaps because of retirement, those farms are being sold to Hispanic farmers. By the way, typically who started out by being workers on those very fields that they now own. Nothing, I think, speaks to the American dream more than that. And in our opinion, as an association, there's nothing more American or more entrepreneurial than owning a ranch or a farm. I think it's the foundation of the American economy. And there again, we see Hispanics playing, I think, a very interesting role. Hispanics are the largest ethnic minority group of farmers in the U.S., and they are twice as large as any other minority segment in farming. On the other end of the spectrum, for lack of a better way to put it, is Hispanics in technology. We did a study, albeit a fairly small study, and we looked at Hispanics and their use and ownership of mobile technology specifically. I think we all understand, and certainly ask any of the students in this room, that mobile technology is really where it's at. That's where banking is going to go. That's where entertainment is going to go. That's where everything is going to go. Of those surveyed, we surveyed over 1,000 Hispanic business owners. 82% of them attributed greater productivity to the use of mobile devices. And 62% said that mobile technology literally helped them grow their business. Now, think about the implications of this if you are Wells Fargo, or you're AT&T, or you're Apple, for that matter. Think about the implications of this community that's growing disproportionately, that's already illustrating a real love for all things technological and certainly for mobile technology. I think that the implications on a very broad basis are astounding. And I think, in my opinion, very, very, very positive. And then finally, certainly, I think international trade is an opportunity, not only for the Hispanic community, but for America in general. If you think about the fact that today, 95% of the world's consumer market actually exists outside of the United States. As big as our economy is, we're slightly less than 5% of the global economy. So said another way, the real growth potentially exists outside of the U.S. And I think you see some states, and again, I think Utah and Governor Gary Herbert is illustrative of those people in those states that are thinking forward. You'll see, I think, a large investment in time, energy, and resources to look at the international marketplace. Interestingly, for every $1 billion in exports of U.S. goods to another country creates roughly 5,000 American jobs. And in 2012, exports supported roughly or close to 10 million jobs in America, and including 25% of all the manufacturing jobs in this country. Critically important, I think, to bring manufacturing back to the U.S. And then finally, we are working as an association with the administration on a number of initiatives, but certainly the Trade Promotion Authority and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because at the end of the day, we think that that exporting and international trade are good for America. And once again, the Hispanic community, I think, has a role to play, even in international trade. So I'll give you a very quick view. Can we kind of show our commercial real quick? or you want to just do it? Let me do this, and then we'll show it afterward. So I'll give you a real quick view of kind of the living embodiment of everything I've been talking about. These are people who are members of the United States Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, and I'll give you a smattering of a variety of them. First is a company called Pinnacle Technical Resources. It is the fastest growing company in its industry, which is basically the staffing and workforce solutions industry. It was started and still owned 100% by a young woman named Nina Vaca, who, interestingly, is an immigrant from Ecuador. Her annual revenue is upwards of $600 million a year, and she employs over 4,200 Americans. This is a company called SDI International. It is the largest Hispanic-owned business in American history. The CEO and the founder of the company is Carmen Castillo, also an immigrant from Spain, and she is in business process outsourcing and procurement servicing as well. She is also a member of the United States Hispanic Chamber of Commerce Board of Directors. Her annual revenue is $1.3 billion, and she employs 2,000 Americans. MasTec is the largest Hispanic-owned construction company in America. It was started by a Cuban immigrant and is today run by the son of that immigrant, Jose Mas. They specialize in engineering, building, and installation and maintenance of infrastructure, large infrastructure projects, particularly in the communications industry. Their annual revenue is $4 billion, and they employ upwards of 13,000 Americans. He is also a member of the board of the United States Hispanic Chamber. Molina Healthcare is the largest, bar none, Hispanic company in America with annual revenues of $6.6 billion. They employ 8,000 Americans, and their primary care clinics all over the mostly western side of the United States. And then finally, kind of the crossover act. This is a gentleman named Marcelo Claudet, former member of the United States Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. And he's interesting because I think he kind of foretells the future a little bit. Now, Marcelo was the founder and CEO of a company called Brightstar, which, before he sold it, that was the largest Hispanic-owned business in America, with annual revenues of $11 billion. Marcelo sold it to a Japanese holding company called SoftBank. SoftBank bought something called Sprint. And when they met Marcelo, fell in love with Marcelo, and today Marcelo now has migrated from being an immigrant entrepreneur to being the CEO of the Sprint Corporation. Obviously, Sprint is a telecommunications and wireless company, annual revenues of $35 billion and 36,000 American employees. Every one of these people is or was a member of the United States Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. These individuals are the living embodiment of what our association is truly all about. And they really kind of speak to everything I've been talking about: educational attainment, the entrepreneurial spirit of the Hispanic entrepreneur, immigrants, and kind of the contributions that these immigrants are making to the American way of life by growing our economy, creating jobs, and paying taxes. And now I think we can play a small ad that kind of speaks to the USHCC, and it's literally our commercial.
America's Hispanic firms are open for business. The United States Hispanic Chamber of Commerce represents the interests of 3.2 million Hispanic-owned businesses that together contribute over $468 billion to the American economy each year. Our members are driving growth in every industry across this land of opportunity. Every tax bill we pay, every job we create, every product we manufacture, and every service we provide goes to benefit this American economy. And while we advocate on behalf of businessmen and women who happen to be of Hispanic descent, we never forget that we are first and foremost American businesses. the United States Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, America's business future.
That's it. Hopefully that makes sense to you, and that's my story, kids. I'm sticking to it. Questions?
Javier, thank you so much for being here.
Okay.
Absolute honor.
Thanks, Kurt.
To have you. You mentioned a little bit about the politics. Obviously, Mitt Romney did worse than McCain. McCain did worse than and on. Besides immigration, which is the obvious one, are there some things that Republicans need to do to start making the presidential elections more competitive again?
Well, again, just a disclaimer, the United States Hispanic Chamber of Commerce is not a political organization. We are blessed to be able to work with both sides of the political spectrum. And so we count among our friends everything from President Obama and Joe Biden all the way to Kurt Jowers and Grover Norquist and John McCain and so many other wonderful American leaders. I do think, and this is my personal opinion, that the Republican Party could do so much more. I think the good news is that, again, if you speak to the ethos of that party and what it stands for, and you look at the Hispanic community, in fact, there's a wonderful match there. I would love to see members of the Republican Party speak to that and start talking about this community as an asset that can help our country become and continue to be the greatest nation in the world. This is a nation of immigrants. I think I don't think anybody debates that. The real question is, what do we do with this fresh crop of immigrants that are here today, and how do we humanize that potential? I believe that there are some in the party that I've spoken to personally, many that I've spoken to personally, about the Hispanic and the Hispanic vote, the Hispanic community and the Hispanic vote, that clearly understand that. But between that understanding and an articulation as a party in general, I think is where the challenge lies. And people like yourself, Kurt, frankly, I think will play a critical role. Those and people like yourself will determine who the next president of the United States is. I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that Hispanics are going to vote in one direction or the other. I think there's still an opportunity there for both parties, frankly, to speak to the ethos of this community, the hopes, frankly, the fears, and the aspirations of a growing Hispanic electorate. The facts are the facts. The Hispanic community is growing. And again, 50,000 Hispanics turn 18 every single month in this country, and that'll be the case for 21 years to come. So as a party, and you know, it's not even the presidency. It's if you want to run for elected office, from dog catcher to president of the United States, who's going to be the people that are going to be voting for you in the future, and how do you begin to identify, in this case, your party with that growing electorate? We stand ready as an association and have, I think, done already a lot, and we will continue to help both ends of the political spectrum and those who ask for our help to try to find a voice that really resonates with this growing electorate.
All right, we now have a microphone, so if you'll just wait for me to bring that to you.
My name is John Margetts. I'm a business owner of a small company here in Utah called Dynapac. I'm just curious, I saw on one of your slides at the end there was some mention of some upcoming trade missions. What tools do I have as a small business owner to sell into Latin America?
Yeah. Well, certainly, I think you're about to hear from one of the leaders in that dialogue, the ambassador. I hope and I'm sure will be kind of speaking to the potential that exists certainly in Mexico and the rest of Latin America. I think the first tool you have is the fact, the first asset that you have is the fact that you live in a state that is amazingly forward-thinking. I know that Governor Herbert has led already a couple of delegations. There are several individuals in the leadership of this state that understand the potential that lies beyond the American borders and is, I think, specifically looking at Mexico as some potential partner to continue to grow the local economy. The reality of it is, with the advent of the technology that's available to us, with the growth of the Hispanic population in this state, with the, I think, the leadership and the philosophy of the leadership in this state in terms of its willingness to collaborate in an effort to grow the economy, you're very well positioned, certainly better than some small business owners in other states where that simply isn't the case. So I think that there's going to be a lot of opportunity as we look forward here. If anybody, and I just had the opportunity to sit with several of the gentlemen in this room and the governor, and he very candidly spoke about the potential that exists in his efforts as he will continue to try to grow this economy by doing trade with Mexico and beyond. Questions? Anybody else?
Hello. Thank you, Javier. I'm Alejandro Cerilde.
No pressure.
The deputy chief of mission of the Mexican embassy here in, well, I work there in Washington. I will try to address that question. It's very, very interesting in my presentation. Position I would take about this is trying to focus on the maturity of the chains of production that are in our region. That today provokes that if your company can be part of one of these chains that are very, very sophisticated. I was telling to someone that there are products that cross the Mexico-U.S. border seven times to become a product at the end, most in the automotive area, for example, in which youth is having a great impact in some of the auto parts that are provoking good cars to be sold all over around the world. Mexico is today the fourth producer of cars. But a little bit in that direction, and after thanking Javier for this great and comprehensive vision about the importance of Hispanic population here, I was puzzled and challenged by one of your statements about the TPP. You know that in Mexico there's a debate about if it's going to be a free trade agreement that is going to harm our very special position that we have acquired because of NAFTA or not, and I'm in the position that no, that give us another area of opportunity to put into the relationship, things that were not addressed by the famous NAFTA. What is exactly to elaborate a little more in that area, what the chamber is doing and the vision the chamber has about this possible free trade agreement of the Pacific?
Yes, sir. I think both in terms of the TPA and the TPP, I think that the opportunity that exists is for our nation to a large extent level the playing field between us and trade partners all over this world. I think programs such as this will afford us an opportunity to enhance the trade that we currently have. Why would other countries that are looking to do trade with the United States be interested in Trans-Pacific or the partnership? The reality of it is that we want to do trade with countries that treat workers the same way we treat workers. We want to do trade with countries that value the environment and nature to the extent that we do. We want to do trade with nations that create the same level of quality of products as we do here in the United States. So to the extent that we can create a block of international opportunities that say, you know what, that is good, and I am willing to step up to that, and I will trade with countries that feel the same way about child labor and workers' rights and just a panacea of issues that, frankly, can be looked upon by our business economy as a hindrance to doing business because you've got to put up with all these regulations. Or if we were able to get international trade partners to feel the same way and value the same things that we value, imagine the opportunities that exist then. And so a country that perhaps is looking to do trade with America simultaneously now has 11 other trade partners that automatically become an opportunity for them to do trade. In terms of what we're attempting to do as a nation, The reality of it is, I think we have a very strong understanding that the international market is critically important for the continued growth of our economy, and we can either deal with it or not. And so this is, in a very real sense, leadership by America, trying to create partnerships. Mexico has long been a trading partner of the United States. And I think one of the things that, one of the opportunities I think that we have as it relates specifically to Mexico and our neighbors to the south is, as a nation, a realization of what this relationship really means to America. I guess about a year ago, I had an opportunity to speak to President Obama right before he was going to Mexico and I think Costa Rica, I forget. He was embarking on a trip to Latin America. And very candidly, I said to the president, I said, Mr. President, I would ask that you, as the leader of the greatest economy on the globe, take an opportunity to change the narrative that has for too long defined the relationship between Mexico specifically and America. Every time that I turn on the news or I turn on a television in America, I hear about Mexico and I hear about rampant drug wars and I hear about this horde of Mexicans coming across the border and I hear about mass murders. And perhaps it's true and we shouldn't turn a deaf ear or a blind eye to those issues. They're real and they should be dealt with. But never, Mr. President, never do I hear about the fact that Mexico is the second largest trading partner to America, has been for 78 years, bigger than Brazil, bigger than India, bigger than England, bigger than France, bigger than Germany, and the list goes on, sir. By the way, that's the same in Univision. I don't hear about it in Univision or Telemundo, for that matter. But we as a society of Americans should understand the amazing opportunity and partnership that we have with this willing buyer just south of us. Some 42%, I think, of all goods that leave the United States are willingly purchased in Mexico, whether that's pickups or Levi's or televisions or coffee makers or shoes or suits, you name it. That's an asset that as a nation we should all be aware of, whether you're a housewife in Ohio or whether you're the leader of the United States Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. The reality of it is, this is an asset, and we should all as Americans treasure that asset and work at making it an even greater asset as we move forward. TPP and TPA, I think, are the latest steps in trying to normalize and ensure that those kinds of assets exist in other places other than Mexico. Anything else? Any other questions? I hope I answered your question, sir, in a way that makes sense to you.
Hi, my name is Dennis Tenney. I'm on the City Council in Sandy, but I've been involved in international trade for many years. I helped organize the first trade mission from Utah to Mexico in the early 1990s. I have two questions for you.
Uh-huh.
You know the saying that if you owe one bank, the bank owns you. But if you owe two banks, you own the banks. In that respect, what is the U.S. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce doing to reach out to the Republican Party at the national level as well as the local levels to educate them so that the Hispanics do not become too beholden to one party and thus lose their influence? That's my first question. The second question is, what is the U.S. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce doing with respect to outreach and supporting President Obama in his initiative to reach out to Cuba? I was in Cuba several years ago. They're wonderful people. They're probably some of the most friendly American people in Latin America. They don't like the U.S. government, mm-hmm. but they're extremely friendly. There's a golden economic and social opportunity mm-hmm. to enhance human rights and increase their living standards. Would you please address those two issues?
So the first question was, what are we doing to help the Republican Party
reach out and promote a guest worker program and other things to help mm-hmm. them see the light? Mm-hmm.
Well, again, we are not a lobbying organization, or we're not a political organization. But certainly, in the context of business and the potential for business growth, and certainly Hispanic entrepreneurs and the potential for their growth, we have met and continue to meet with many leaders in the Republican Party. to ensure that the position of and it's an interesting recalibration. Ours is not a Hispanic business issue. Ours is an American business issue. We're about American small business, not Hispanic small business. So a point of clarification. So when we speak to leaders on both ends of the political spectrum, it really is about the needs and the growth of American small business. And in that context, it's always been about, listen, we're less about politics than we are about helping the American economy and helping American small businesses grow. What are the policies? What are the regulations that are important to us? One of the assets that we have, and I've been very keen on using this asset, is this thing that is 200 local chambers throughout the United States that represent voters, taxpayers, et cetera. So we'll go see a certain congressman or a key leader in a particular committee, and we'll remind him or her that, hey, listen, I've got 34 chambers in your state, and they represent X number of dollars and X number of taxes and X number of businesses, and we're going to be watching what you do on this particular bill. Have a great day, but we'll wait to hear from you. It's amazing the kind of interest you instantly get when you approach it from that perspective. So for us, our challenge, frankly, is keeping up with the demand that we have from senators and congressmen and leaders in the political spectrum that are calling us constantly for an opinion or some guidance. We are a small organization. I don't believe in huge staffs. I believe in influence and hard work, and we've been fortunate in that regard. But oftentimes, we can address an issue from a minimum of three different perspectives. One, the 200 local chambers that are members of our association. Two, the 3.2 million Hispanic American business owners that are paying taxes. And three, the 249 major American corporations whose interests we represent. Somewhere in there, there's going to be a very interesting dialogue with any leader in the American political spectrum. In terms of what are we doing to help Republicans specifically, we have a responsibility to not lean one way or the other. Ours is this sometimes unenviable but very fascinating accountability and responsibility to put the camel to the proverbial eye of the needle and ensuring that our voice is always right down the middle. It's always about the economic and commercial interests of this nation. It's not about swaying one way or the other in political views or philosophy or ideology, but rather what's good for American business. We've been, I think, helpful in ensuring that friends of ours who we wanted to see in office, in fact, got into office. Maria Contreras Sweet was the fastest, I think went through the process fastest, and was the only non-contested nominee of the president's. In fact, and in the entire, I believe, in the entire Obama administration, Maria Contreras Sweet was the only nominee that was completely uncontested. And she received her her nomination, went from nomination to being approved, I think, in record time. I think some of that was due to the fact that we were working with our friends on the right and saying, listen, this is not about being Hispanic. This is not about being an immigrant. This is not about being a woman. This is about somebody who has a proven track record of creating opportunities to fund small businesses in fashion that made sense and grew local economies and created jobs. Who better to ascend to this post and address and advise the president literally on a one-to-one basis than this woman who's created this kind of job? Never mind that she happens to be an immigrant. Never mind she happens to be Hispanic, that she happens to be a woman, and she happens to be a member of our association. She's the right and the best American candidate for that job. And that's the way we approach it. It seems to be working. And I think it works predominantly because we don't make it about being Hispanic. We have a shared interest in ensuring that America is doing better every single day. And we have as big a responsibility, if not bigger, to make sure that our voice is being heard in a very responsible fashion. And I don't think I have time to answer the second question. I apologize. But anyway, thank you all very much. I very much enjoyed it. And Kirk, I don't know if you have anything else for me. But
please join me in thanking our speaker for an informative and fascinating.
Thank you.